real good afternoon, panel. It's just about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. You're in tune with KTOO News. We're in the middle of Juneau afternoon, or just starting Juneau afternoon. Pat Moore, your host today. We'll have some folks here from the Disaster Preparedness Office here in Juneau to tell us about Preparedness Month. We'll also have some folks here to talk to us about the other September month, which is Recovery Month. Folks from Search, I hope. Sustainability Fair is the segment of the show where we did a bunch of on-the-street interviews with people at the farmers market on Saturday, and we're going to be hearing how they define sustainability for Juneau. And the UAS School of Career and Technical Education will come by and tell us about a bunch of classes for before and after high school students. Weather looks like mostly cloudy for the rest of the day. Scattered showers, highs around 57. Tonight, decreasing clouds, slight chance of rain in the evening. The lows around 46 and east winds at about 5 miles per hour.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The remains of a Lakota man who died in Connecticut more than a century ago were returned to South Dakota over the weekend. As Jim Kent reports, it's been a long journey home for Albert, afraid of Hawk.
When Buffalo Bill's Wild West show toured the world in 1900, Albert, afraid of Hawk, went along. But the 20-year-old only made it as far as Danbury, Connecticut. In a sad twist of fate, the healthy young Lakota man fell ill from food poisoning and died. Resting in an unmarked grave in the Danbury Cemetery, Albert's remains went unnoticed until 2008. That's when a cemetery worker saw his name on a burial card. After 4 years of research and red tape, family spokesperson Marlis Afraid of Hawk is happy her ancestor is home.
It's finally happening. You know, it finally happened, and this came about. It's for his whole family as well as the Oglala Sioux tribe. And the people at Danbury, Connecticut, they were very welcoming with open arms. You know, this is something very sacred.
A traditional burial service is planned for Albert Afraid of Hawk on the Pine Ridge Reservation this Saturday. For National Native News, I'm Jim Kent.
The Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota is getting a credit union. U.S. Senator Tim Johnson announced Friday the National Credit Union Association has approved a federal credit union to serve the reservation. The Lakota Federal Credit Union is expected to open in coming months. Johnson said in a press release, it will be an engine for economic development and job creation on the reservation. It's being sponsored by Lakota Funds, a nonprofit community development financial institution. The credit union will offer financial literacy education and a full range of financial services. The Cherokee Nation is appealing the federal government's decision to allow another tribe to operate a casino within its historical tribal lands. KGOU's Kurt Gortney has more.
The lawsuit says the U.S. Interior Department's decision in July violated longstanding treaty rights. Cherokee Nation Attorney General Todd Henry's court filing says the justification the Bureau of Indian Affairs used to place land into trust for the United Kituwa Band of Cherokees is contrary to prior agency and court decisions on the issue. The Kituwa's casino sits on 2.03 acres of land in Tahlequah, Oklahoma. The much larger Cherokee Nation claims exclusive rights to the land of its historic reservation area in eastern Oklahoma. Henry's appeal also says the federal law does not allow the Interior Secretary to place land in trust for any entity not under federal jurisdiction in 1934 when the law was enacted. The United Kituwa Band of Cherokees was not given federal recognition until the 1940s. The Cherokee Nation is asking a federal judge to block the trust decision until the matter can be settled in the courts. The Kituwas referred questions on the case to their attorney, who did not respond to telephone calls. For National Native News, I'm Kurt Gwartney.
Five tribes in Washington state are awarded $1 million in federal grants. The money will help improve sex offender monitoring on tribal lands. According to the Associated Press, U.S. Attorney for the District of Washington, Jenny Durkin, says the grants will help tribes create sex offender registration programs. Montana State Superintendent of Public Instruction Denise Juneau will address the Democratic National Convention this week. Juneau is Mandan and Hidatsa. Her statewide work has included Indian education issues. Juneau, who's running for re-election, is expected to speak on Wednesday. The convention is being held in Charlotte, North Carolina. During this week in 2010, the Paiapop First Nation in Saskatchewan, Canada, honored its famous chief and the 135th anniversary of Treaty 4. Chief Paiapop, who signed the treaty, was known to be a brave warrior, but also a peaceful negotiator who championed the rights of his people. 3 days of celebrations included the unveiling of a statue and an orchestra performance. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kowanic Broadcast Corporation. Funding comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, the McCune Charitable Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the Nathan Cummings Foundation. And by the law firm of Sanosky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller & Munson, advocating Native American interests throughout the United States, with offices in New Mexico, California, Alaska, and Washington, D.C. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
It's 5 minutes and a half after 3 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News. This is Juno Afternoon. Pat Moore, your host today, and I have two folks here with me who have to do with preparedness planning for Juno. September, I guess, is National Preparedness Month. September is a couple of months, but this is the first one we're going to talk about today. And so with me are Michelle Brown, who's part of the local emergency planning committee, and Jeremy Johnson, who's a member of the Community Emergency Response Team. Welcome to the show.
Greetings.
Thank you.
So what should we be doing now that it's September and Preparedness Month?
Well, I think that the best thing for me to tell you is that our community and small businesses need to act now. We've been for years filling them full of great information, but we need them to act now.
And so what would you have them act doing?
I'm going to turn that one over to Jeremy.
Okay, Jeremy.
Well, the CERT program suggests that all of the local businesses be prepared for an actual disaster under the circumstances, something large like an avalanche or an earthquake, something that has a dramatic city impact. You have to kind of expect your business and your home to be able to sustain a lack of contact for a little bit of time. So my favorite two examples, the earthquake and the avalanche, are separatist events. They force you to be separated from emergency responders for a while. Like, for instance, in an earthquake, a bridge might go out, and you could be separated from EMTs by a matter of hours if they need to come by boat, or by days if there's a lot of tragic events happening in their geocentric area. So the kind of preparedness that I'm generally talking about is being prepared for supporting your family and your local community with things as simple as food and flashlights, a place to gather, making sure that your local community has an idea of who you can go and see in times of emergency. Another thing to consider is for the CERT responders, we will be kind of expected to be the local community organizers for these sorts of things. And under the circumstance of an actual disaster where it's non-critical, but still we want to see that the CERT responders are coming out, would be like under the circumstance of the earthquake, you know, we would go door to door and make sure our neighborhood is doing well, making sure that everybody's taken care of in that respect. For me, I've got a baby, and I always think about, do I have enough diapers for a week? You know, if I don't meet anybody for a week, do I have enough wipes? You know, is there enough little oatmeal over here and things like that? For businesses, you know, things like power and real critical services are called into question. Well, that's a higher level of concern. But yeah, Michelle.
I also, as far as businesses go, the businesses could be the business of putting that power back online, or things that are the critical services, and they need their employees to be able to come to work.
Absolutely.
So super important for those businesses to assist their employees in any way they can to have themselves and their families prepared for, because they aren't going to show up at work if their families are still being worried about.
Absolutely.
So you mentioned CERT teams several times. Are there are they scattered out throughout the area? Do you have people who are formed as teams?
Well, across the state of Alaska, there are CERT programs that are doing more activities. Our local CERT team had been active in 2002 to 2004, and then the UAS CERT team, which I was a member of, from I think 2008 to 2011, that group is now the current most active group in town, and so I am the volunteer coordinator for CERT, and we're starting the leadership initiative this month. The email is due to go out this week about September 22nd. Leadership training where we have basically the people that have been following along for the past 2 to 10 years, depending in some cases. And we're looking to revitalize the CERT program here locally. So, yes, there are plenty of groups scattered about. No, there isn't a fully formed group in Juneau until now. So I'm expecting that the 10 people that came for the initial refresher will have a positive response to the leadership training, and then the other 70 people that were on the list that determined that they would remain on the list and be active will be able to get their turn at the refresher courses that we're doing.
So ideally then you're saying that about 80 people would be needed to form the CERT teams in Juneau?
Well, to be frank, I think that every citizen everywhere should be at least as informed as possible when it comes to the kinds of things that we're talking about. The things as basic as home first aid or CPR, fire drills, what to do in case of a local close-to-home emergency. And then the CERT team would expand to the larger scale, my neighborhood is impacted, that kind of thing, before any formal emergency responders arrive. So the kinds of things that we teach and learn in CERT is how to bring together a local community in the case of a disaster, how to be prepared for simple triage, or how to extricate people from buildings in the case that no other emergency responder is available. You know, we talk about the safety risks and we talk about the liability risks and that kind of thing inside of the program. But the program really is geared to give common citizens the tools needed to be able to assist in the case of a real emergency. Like, the number one thing that we say is to hand off to real emergency responders when they get there.
So, Michelle, you had talked about a website that people can go to, a government website that kind of had an inventory and some information.
Absolutely.
That people can go to.
Absolutely. It is called ready.gov. That's ready.gov. And it's online, and it has all kinds of templates. It has games to help your children get involved with this. It has lists of what kind of supplies that you need to have, and that includes first aid supplies, food, shelter,
yes,
things to keep you warm. It's a very, very comprehensive website, and it takes you through the making the plan for your family. It takes you through building a kit, how to, what's the contents, and how to use them. And what I'd like to stress is that if you get prepared, you're going to be part of the solution rather than part of the problem. And that's going to help everyone, because it's going to free up the CERT team and responders to go take care of those who are at the highest need. And so if each of us would take the initiative, we're all smart people, we're Alaskans, we know how to take care of ourselves, but nobody can take care of themselves unless they have a plan and the people know what the plan is. So if you want your family to be safe, even in a loss of a job or a health problem for your family, it's all training the same way. So planning the same way, it will help you and your family in all kinds of circumstances, small and big.
It seems to me I remember a year ago there was a preparedness fair, I think, that lasted one
yeah.
or two
Correct.
Days, and it was at the
yes.
convention
Hall,
center.
Yeah.
Right.
Are you doing something like that for this month?
Not this year. Last year, it was very well received. The community of response teams, the emergency responders, they all agreed that it was a real good project, but they don't want to overwhelm the community or the resources, and so they've decided to do biannually. So every other year, they'll be... So next year, we expect to see another one at the convention center.
Right. Okay. In addition to the LEPC, I also work, my real job is the Emergency Preparedness Coordinator for grants with the City and Borough of Juneau, and we're the ones that put on that expo, teaming with a whole bunch of other partners, and we're a very small department, and so we did decide to do it right. We need to do it biannually, and the people want it, and so that's our plan, is to do it biannually.
We just have a minute or so left. I'm wondering how people can proceed from here. Go to the website.
Go to the website,
ready.gov. Okay. And Jeremy, are there other activities that people need to be involved in other than your training seminars?
Well, I always think that it's very important to get all of the community involved. I'd like to take a moment to mention people like the Gassineau Humane Society that has emergency response ideas and kits for pets. And it's not just cats and dogs, you know. If you register your pet with them, then you're taking precautions for your family members, essentially. I also wanted to take a second to say that if you have little ones at home, you need to think about where they can stay while you go take care of business, especially if you're an electric line worker or, some sort of main service that's going to be impacted. Who's going to watch your family and watch your kids while you go to work on these emergency things? That's really part of the emergency preparedness, is to make sure that you're not just thinking of yourself and the common things, but those less common things that are important to you.
Okay. Michelle Brown with the LAPC
mm-hmm.
and the Disaster Preparedness Office here in Juneau,
mm-hmm.
and Jeremy Johnson with CERT Teams. Thank you so much for alerting us to the fact that this mm-hmm. is Preparedness Month, and we hope people will get prepared.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
Tune in with me, Angelina, your host of Tideline, on Wednesday night, 5 to 7, as I kick it with local pop singer Evie in the KRNN studio. Don't miss it Wednesday, 5 to 7 on KRNN 102.7.
But I just want to cry the day away. It's just so hard.
This is Bird Note. Barn swallows. North America's most abundant and widely distributed swallows, the ones with the deep blue back, the dark orange throat, and that elegant forked tail, are heading south by now. Many of these long-distance migrants will follow the Central American isthmus into South America. High concentrations pass through New Jersey's Cape May in late August and early September. Barn swallows all across the country will have departed by late September. It's pretty hard to even imagine what it would take to make this trip on your own steam, isn't it? Here's Oregon birding guide Harry Fuller.
Just think about it. You got this tiny little brain that's smaller than a walnut, and you spend the summer in Oregon, and you've got to go to Chile for the winter because you're a barn swallow. And you can do that in less than 2 months. Give that job to a human being and think the obstacles that they would face if they couldn't go to the airport and buy a ticket. You know, if they had to do it on their own with their own body and their own strength and gather their food every day. So we shouldn't make fun of bird brains. They can do incredible things that we would never be able to manage.
We're learning amazing new things about bird migration. And you can find out more on our website, birdnote.org. Today's show brought to you by the Bobolink Foundation. Can't always hear Bird Note on the radio? Well, get the next week of shows every Friday when you sign up for weekly preview at birdnote.org.
It's 19 minutes after 3 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News. This is Juneau Afternoon, and my next guest is here to tell us about National Recovery Month, which has a number of activities that are going on here in Juneau. Michelle Federico is here. Hi.
Hi.
So, Michelle, I understand you're going to do some things like a film festival and a number of other social events and things like that, all as part of Recovery Month.
Yes, we are.
Is Recovery Month, who runs it? Who starts this month?
Whose idea was this? Well, it's sponsored by the advisory board and all. It's SAMHSA. It's a national event sponsored primarily by SAMHSA, which kind of oversees the addiction and mental health services and information nationwide.
Okay, and locally you're with Search?
No, I'm with Gastineau Human Services
in
their substance abuse treatment program, which is an outpatient program.
Okay.
But this is sponsored by a lot of different groups all over town, JAMI, Polaris House, Search, Juneau Youth Services, the Alaska Mental Health Board, the Alaska Mental Health Trust, the Addiction Professionals, the Advisory Board on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse. So there's lots of us. Gold Town Nickelodeon's been extremely helpful to us. So, and yeah, there are going to be a number of different events. And I can tell you.
Okay, so what's going to happen?
All right, well, starting tomorrow, we're going to kick off our Recovery Film Festival with a movie called Candy, which is going to start at 6:30 p.m. down at the Gold Town Nick. And it's a pretty intense movie about heroin addiction between a couple that fall in love and are equally as addicted to each other as they are to their drug of choice. And it's pretty triggering for those that are in recovery from IV drug use. So we're going to have an open discussion at the end of the movie for about 15 minutes. There are going to be other addicts in recovery there to help folks if need be. It shouldn't be that emotional, but, you know, it might be. And so then the following Wednesday and every Wednesday for three Wednesdays in a row, we're going to have additional movies. And the next one on September 12th will be Down to the Bone, which I actually haven't seen myself, but Terry Tibbetts saw it, and she said it was pretty good.
Terry Tibbetts is?
She's part of the coordinating effort, one of the advocates in coordinating this event. And then, of course, my favorite is the Bill W. movie, which is going to be held on September 19th at 6:30. And it's a new documentary, the story of Bill W., who's the founder of a very important program that we all know called Alcoholics Anonymous.
Mm-hmm.
FASD Awareness Day is September 9th, and it's kind of a citywide selected restaurants will provide non-alcoholic beverages for pregnant women. So that's kind of fun for to encourage our pregnant ladies not to drink. September 15th, we have a recovery walk. Kind of kicked off by folks at Search, and they're going to meet at Marine Park and walk to Sandy Beach at 1 o'clock on September 15th. The event that I'm most involved with is the Swing Into Recovery Dance, and that's on September 21st from 8 to 11, so the folks at the 7:07 AA meeting can come because we'll be kicking things off at 8 o'clock.
Uh-huh.
Anytime you want to interrupt me, go ahead.
No, you're doing a great job.
And that's going to be held at the Rockwell, which is the old Elks Club, and it's going to be upstairs. There's going to be refreshments and alcohol-free environment. We're actually going to have a fellow named Daniel Martin teaching beginner swing lessons, which is fun for those of us that don't know how to dance and certainly don't know how to dance sober.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to be a live band, so I'm hoping that...
and the band is called Swing Bada, Bada Bing?
Swing Bada Bing, I
there
guess.
There you go. Okay.
I don't know. But anyways, okay. I'm looking forward to it, and I'm hoping that folks in recovery will come out to that as well.
The events that you've talked about
mm-hmm.
are all sort of aimed at people in recovery. But is there a wider audience here?
Yeah, it's anybody who wants to have fun. Because those of us in recovery, we have a hard time figuring out how to have fun and how to have fun without drugs and alcohol. So this is really meant to, and mental illness as well. I mean, folks with mild depression, major depression, other types of disorders that may make them feel a little different than other people. This is an opportunity for us all to get together. But yeah, it's for the public. It's Juneau-wide. This isn't meant just for people who are in recovery. And kids can come, too.
Particularly, I think this film series sounds...
it's adult.
Yeah, it's adult films, but
mm-hmm.
There's some real dramatic content.
Yeah, I would say rated, R.
Yeah.
There's language.
Yeah, don't
and
bring
content.
The kids.
Yeah.
Right.
Except for the Bill W. one. I don't know because I haven't seen that.
Right.
But Then there's one more event.
Okay.
Do we have time to talk about
sure.
that? Okay, that's the Poetry Slam. Mm. And that's also held in the same place in the Rockwell on 109 South Franklin Street, September 28th from 6:30 to 9. And this is a really fun event for folks that are writers or performers and that want to compete for prizes, for cash prizes, and read their poetry aloud. And the audience votes. It's kind of a fun competitive experience. And then if you don't want to compete and you just, like me, want to read your stuff, 6:30 to 7, there's going to be an open mic. So that would be the non-competitive portion.
And the theme for these presentations should be recovery.
It should be recovery. It should be about, by folks who are in recovery from addiction or alcoholism or mental illness, mental health issues. And about recovery, too.
Michelle, there's a bunch of events, then, that are scheduled for the month of September. Let's run through the schedule just one more time. On Wednesdays from 6:30 to 9, there's a movie at the Gold Town each week on the 5th, 12th, and the 19th. And there is the FASD Day on September 9th. That's where?
It's at select restaurants citywide. There's no actual event. It's just going to happen on
okay.
that day.
Okay, so just an awareness day.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the recovery walk starts at Marine Park on September 15th at 1. The swing into recovery dance is September 21st from 8 till 11. And the poetry slam is on September 28th from 6:30 to 9,
mm-hmm.
with an open mic from 6:30 to 7. If all of this happens, what do you hope will come about as a result of this being Recovery Month?
I hope people have fun. That's really what it's about. It's about having a good time.
Good. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks for coming down and telling us about it.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday, the 4th of September, 2012. It was on this day in 1998 that Google was incorporated, the brainchild of two PhD students at Stanford, Larry Page and Sergey Brin, who designed a search engine that was different from the others. Instead of giving you results based on how many times your search term appeared on a web page, they created software that would figure out how many times each relevant website was linked to from other relevant websites, and sorted those and then laid them out for you on a very clear, simple screen. In June of 2006, Google was added to the Oxford English Dictionary as a verb. It's the birthday of Richard Wright, born on a plantation near Natchez, Mississippi, 1908, came north, became a writer, author of the novel Native Son, came out in 1940, about a black man, Bigger Thomas, gets a job as a chauffeur for a beautiful young white woman, accidentally kills her. A huge bestseller when it came out, made into a Broadway play, now required reading at many high schools. This day in 1666 was the most destructive day of the Great Fire of London, which had begun a few days before, people scurrying to get their possessions out of the path of the fire. And the diarist Samuel Pepys wrote about the chaos and confusion in the streets, the people running, pushing carts full of belongings, the fire coming on in the narrow streets with infinite fury. He wrote, "I saw how horridly the sky looks all on a fire in the night was enough to put us out of our wits, and indeed it was extremely dreadful, for it looks just as if it was at us and the whole heaven on fire. I, after supper, walked in the dark down to Tower Street, and there saw it all on fire, at the Trinity House on that side and the Dolphin Tavern on this side, which was very near us, and the fire with extraordinary vehemence." The system of firefighting basically was to demolish houses in the path of the fire, hoping to create a fire break. The following day, September the 5th, the Great Fire was officially over, and it all started on September the 2nd when the King's Baker in Putting Lane had neglected to turn the ovens off all the way. London was a city of 80,000 people, and historians estimate that the Great Fire destroyed the homes of 70,000 of them, as well as almost 90 churches, all the official buildings. St. Paul's Cathedral was burned, and all of medieval London within the old Roman city wall. Here's a poem for today by W.S. Merwin, entitled The Highway. It seems too enormous just for a man to be walking on, as if it and the empty day were all there is, and a little dog trotting in time with the heat waves off near the horizon, seeming never to get any farther. The sun and everything are stuck in the same places, and the ditch is the same all the time, full of every kind of bone, while the empty air keeps humming that sound it has memorized of things going past. And the signs, with huge heads and starved bodies, doing dances in the heat, and the others big as houses, all promise, but with nothing inside and only one wall, tell of other places where you can eat, drink, get a bath, lie on a bed, listening to music, and be safe. If you look around, you see it is just the same the other way going back, and farther now to where you came from, probably, than to places you can reach by going on. The Highway by W.S. Merwin, from the first four books of poems published by Copper Canyon Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, produced by Nick Vedder, written by Betsy Allister. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
This is the beginning of a series of programs that will be airing on Juno afternoon during the month of September. Every Tuesday afternoon for the month of September from 3:30 until 3:45, we'll have a special program that deals with the issues of sustainability in Juno. Last Saturday was the Juno Arts and Humanities Center's last farmer's market of the season. They had a room full and a lawn full of exhibitors over there and a lot of folks in attendance. One of the organizations that helped organize the Jack's Farmer's Markets was the Juno Commission on Sustainability, and so we took the opportunity to walk around and ask a number of exhibitors and people strolling through the booth this question. What is sustainability in terms of Juno? What does it mean to us here? The responses showed us that a lot of people are seriously thinking about how Juno sustains itself now and into the future. We'll let the folks we interviewed speak for themselves.
Michelle Donahue. Well, I think we're kind of unique here because everything gets shipped in, and we're so dependent on, you know, airplanes and barges and the price of fuel that you have to start thinking about doing things for yourself. And so anything you can do to, you know, handmade, homemade, help.
Mike Domkowski. I think it means that we, as best as possible, can produce the food that we need with as little fuel as possible, that we can get our energy needs as locally as possible, that we can get our, and that means heating and electricity, food as local as possible. I guess it comes down to getting what we need for food, shelter, lighting, energy, heat, as local as possible.
My name is Delina Quick. It's so important for us to not only keep up with the environment and how we're taking care of it, because we need it not only here for us for right now, but we need it later on for our children and our grandchildren. And the better we take care of our land, and the better we watch our tides and take care of how we live our lives and do it in a green sense, I think the longer it'll be here for us. And I think that's very important for Juno. When we're watching the tides, it tells us when we can fish, when we can hunt, when we can get clams, and the things that we need. And there's a lot of myths that are involved. We don't always follow them. But because of this coastal management thing that's going on right now, it's really important for us to take care of our tides, because if they're polluting our waters, we're losing our ground. Like Juno, you could go down and fish in the channel back in the early 1900s and the 1800s. Then the tourist ship started coming in, the steamships, the gold miners, and pretty soon the fish were not coming back to their up and going up the creeks that they used to go up.
My name's Sanjay Piare.
Sustainability for Juno means basically increasing the sort of investment in local consumable goods. I think the more we can grow, the more we can make, the more we can rely on things that are locally made. That's sort of a one vision of sustainability.
Grady Saunders. Sustainability, I think, for anywhere is great, both worldwide and in Juneau. Sustainability means that we can move forward and continue to move forward, developing products, developing enterprise, developing people to produce, create, sell, and redo it again for the community.
Emily Rooney.
I think sustainability for Juneau is being able to keep as many things in the community as possible and also being as self-reliant as possible and being less dependent on outside resources, whether that's like in food, in energy, and just in the community in general, like people helping each other out.
I'm Ann Domkowski. Well, I think Rick Bellog pretty much defines that outside here. He's got he's growing an incredible garden of vegetables out on Shelter Island.
My name is Rick Bellog. Everybody asks, oh, do you grow tomatoes on Shelter Island? Well, we're not really that interested in trying to grow tomatoes because they don't want to grow here. They're not they need heat, and we don't have heat. So we figured out a whole bunch of things that work really well in Juneau, and we come to the market every year to try to show people. It's not really to sell all our produce to people. It's more about trying to show people what's possible. And so that's what I think about the whole idea of sustainability, is to show people what our climate can produce and then give people just a little bit of incentive to try it themselves. Our best things are our root crops, and I see that our carrots are the most popular right away. Everybody wants to buy all the carrots. And usually I give the carrots away to the kids and then have them, you know, walk around the market. And so lots of root crops, potatoes and carrots and beets and radishes and that sort of thing, turnips. And then greens, obviously, are kale, chard, collards, lettuces, and sorrel. Sorrel is what we really sell. We're really a sorrel farm. So because sorrel is a perennial, and it grows back every year without very much care at all. It likes wet, it likes cold. And it's a wonderful sour green where all your other greens are, you know, they have maybe a little bitterness or kind of a lettuce-y taste, you know. But sorrel is really a nice sour accent to fish. We make the soup every year and sell that at the market. And it's just a really wonderful thing because it's kind of like in the rhubarb family, you know. It has that sourness and I keep thinking that if I keep the market going, I'm going to just close myself right out of the market, because if I keep selling my plants, people are going to grow this stuff at home and they're not going to have to buy it from me anymore. It's called Wabi Sabi Wilderness Farm. Well, Wabi Sabi is the Japanese aesthetic that recognizes beauty in rustic imperfection and the continuous flow of being, becoming, decay, reforming.
My name's Catherine.
Livide.
I was doing Jesuit Volunteer Corps, and I came to Juneau, and I met Rick, and he told me about Shelter Island and his Wabi Sabi farm, and I decided I would come out. So I drove over from Anchorage to Haines and met up with Rick and stayed for 6 weeks and knew that I would come back, and then came back the next year for 2.5 months and closed up the farm after Rick left in mid-November. And then I've come back the last 2 weeks, 2 years, for about 2.5 to 3 weeks, and then this year. My experience of Juneau is predominantly out on Shelter Island, and the farm that Rick and Rogelio have is from my perspective. Kind of gives this vision of that sustainability is possible, and it's possible in an environment that tends to be harsh, that maybe people don't think it's possible. So it's really a hopeful experience, and I think that's kind of important in a community and a part of the world that is tends to be more secluded and doesn't have access to a lot of things to become. So Juno, to me, that experience kind of expresses that Juno is a pretty self-sustaining community of people who, I mean, with all these people out here at this farmers market who seek to learn how to connect with the environment around them in multiple ways and as a means of becoming dependent essentially on the earth, but also dependent upon each other as a community, and in that sense being able to become more self-sustainable.
Well, the farmers market led a lot of our respondents to talk about food sustainability, but it became apparent that Juno thinks about this issue in a much broader sense. So let's return to the market now and listen as these next speakers elaborate on a wider view of sustainability for Juno.
I think a lot of it comes about through food and creating healthy food systems for people, whether that's, you know, through growing food, which is what a lot of people are doing here, or processing their own food or harvesting food, but like creating community through shared food and by creating healthy people through that. I'm the garden coordinator at the Glory Hole, so yep, that's kind of what we're involved in doing and trying to become more sustainable there by having a rooftop and a backyard terrace garden. So we're trying to incorporate food into our meals that we have there and also to be less dependent on outside resources. I mean, so much of what we get is through donation and from the food all comes from outside of Alaska. So not only trying to create like a healthy community, but also lessen our environmental footprint, our eco footprint as well. We've been providing food for the meals there pretty much every day, and we're looking to expand and change. This is the second season that we've been growing there, the first season that my position has been there. So this year it's been a lot of kind of trial and error and developing infrastructure, but next year we are pretty excited to kind of get things going. And you know, in addition to growing food, we're also trying to become like somewhat of a community resource for people who do want to, in the downtown area especially, want to start growing food in small areas. And we want to open up our space to the community to come and join in, because in addition to not only providing food, we want to also kind of merge the Glory Hole and the community together more, and to just kind of expand on the idea that like we are all a part of the greater Juno community, from our patrons at the Glory Hole to the people who volunteer and everybody else. So,
Brian Holst. The other part of sustainability that is more important is sort of the long-term viability of our community, and in that I think I feel real good about that. We've got an economy that's reliant on the seafood industry that could be here forever if we manage it properly. We've got resources here. We've got a creative community. We've got these arts, we're at the Juno Arts and Managed Council. We can't forget about how important the arts are. And that is part of a sustainable community where people are attracted to be here and want to be here for the long haul.
I think it takes, it's you can't depend on a business model for it. And that's sort of the fundamental problem. I mean, growth is good, capitalism is good. But if we really care about this, then in the end, it's kind of a individual and it's a collective decision. We have to basically say this is a priority for us, and this is the direction we want to move in. I would see government taking a role in this, but I think in the end they need to sort of, you know, I think they need to promote. They need to some degree let people come to their own decision too, and just give them opportunities to make that decision. So this is a great venue, right? This is a great venue that isn't in your face, that doesn't tell you that, you know, you need to buy local, but it just really is cool. Anybody who, you know, shops at Home Depot and goes to Costco and goes to Walmart, like we all do here, there's no question about that these days. And you come here and this is way cooler than anything else, you know, you can find in an aisle in Walmart. And so if you agree with that, then we should make this a priority. So.
Voices of Junoites talking about sustainability. Two things became clear from this collection of Juno voices. First, we're concerned about this. And second, we see it as a community thing. Juno is not alone in its concern about how to transition to a greater degree of self-reliance. Over 1,000 communities across the world in Australia, Portugal, Brazil, Slovenia, Britain, Canada, they're all registered on a national website, an international website called the Transition Network. The communities have already started up projects in areas of food, transport, energy, education, housing, waste, arts, and so forth, as we have here in Juneau. These are small-scale local responses to the global challenges of climate change, economic hardship, and possible shrinking supplies of cheap energy as we go into the future. The Transition Network sees these small-scale responses as making up something much bigger. They help to show the way forward for governments, businesses, and individuals. Now, the website echoes the sentiments of our last farmers market interviewee. As they put it, if we wait for the government, it'll be too little, too late. If we act as individuals, it'll be too little. But if we act as communities, it might be just enough, just in time. Juno Afternoon will continue to explore the sustainability issue in relation to our community every Tuesday afternoon through the month of September. Each week, I'll be interviewing a guest or two on this topic in the middle of the show here, 3:30. Please join us every weekday for Juno Afternoon, and especially for these discussions of a sustainable Juno on Tuesdays at 3:30. To 4 o'clock, and we're in tune with KTOO news in Juneau. The weather forecast just popped up again here with a little change, and so they're saying mostly cloudy, isolated rain showers, 44 to 50 for the lows. Southwest winds 10 miles per hour. Those lighten up tonight, and then there's a slight chance of rain in the morning for Wednesday. Wednesday night, rain. Thursday, cloudy with a chance of rain. Thursday night, mostly cloudy with a chance of rain. And Friday, mostly cloudy with a chance of rain. And upcoming for the weekend, rain is likely for both days. So it looks like a Juno week. I think we've got one of those coming up here. One of the things that you can do in Juno on those rainy days is attend a class. There you go. Great transition, right? And Karen Smolin is here from the Juno Schools to talk about career and technical education offerings that are held for high school kids before and after classes. Hi, Karen.
Hi, thank you.
Yeah, so tell us what's up.
Well, we've got some really wonderful course offerings that some of them have begun and some of them start in another week or two, so I thought I'd share with the public about them. There are before school classes that are still open for students to grab, and they're being held at the JD High campus in the 0 hour, which means that it starts at 8 and ends at 9 in the morning, and it's open to all high school kids in our district. One of the courses is called Principles of Engineering, and it's a year-long science course exploring engineering. There's also a video production class. We have a full TV studio, and the students produce a news report every day that gets aired just at the start of school. And it's played on Channel 6 as well throughout the day. And so students who are interested in that kind of career aspiration, could have a lot of fun from producing it to actually being on the TV reporting it. At the same time, we also have a computer-assisted drafting class, otherwise known as CAD, and that's offered in the 0 hour as well. That course is really special because students also earn university credit, three university credits with UAS at the same time they earn a half a high school credit. We have some after-school classes that are also starting up in the next week. Basic construction is the first one on the table. It starts on September 11th, and it goes Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursdays from 4 to 6 p.m. Thunder Mountain High School students can grab the school bus downtown, and there are bus passes provided for students to get home if they need a ride. And that course is also, a student earns a half a high school credit and three University of Alaska credits. And let me explain something about it. It's called dual enrollment, meaning that our high school classes align with the university for the content. And so our teacher's teaching it, and because it's taught on our campus and not in the university, the students get a discounted rate of $75 for the three credits. So it's a wonderful way to start earning and building a college transcript, and even towards the construction management program, the endorsement program, and the further degree programs at UAS Tech by taking some of these classes, whether it's basic construction or our CAD class, even our metals class, which will be offered the second semester for the same time frame. And I can tell you all about it in the winter when I can come back and promote it.
Karen, I wanted to know about basic construction. Is that like house construction? Is that what you're talking about?
It's the basics of what construction is about. It's not building a house. We actually have a class called House Build, and we are building a house. We just finished a house this year. We're starting another house. So we have another class that's a double period class that students can enter. We have a healthy enrollment right now, and we're getting ready to start building our third house this year.
But this course that's offered after school with the UAS credit for it, that's not that same course.
Correct. It's not the same. Okay. It's the basics of what is involved in learning basic construction techniques and tools. They do some small construction activities, and sometimes we bring them out to the house build when we can to help as well.
Okay.
We also have another class that starts in October 1st, and it's ETT, or Emergency Trauma Technician Training. You get three UAS credits with that. It's taught by a state-certified EMS ETT specialist. And so students interested in the health sciences area would enjoy that one. And last but not least, for this semester, there's a new class that we're going to be dual enrollment with the university. They are sponsoring it, and it's Exploring Education Careers. It's going to be taught once a week at the Bill Ray Center and every other week online. It will go the whole school year because it's stretched over once a week on Wednesdays. And students will have practicum experiences helping out in the schools and just learning about the opportunities for education careers in our community and in the state.
So if someone is thinking of becoming a teacher, this is an ideal opportunity to sort of feel things out without...
That's right. It's a great opportunity, and it's just a wonderful connection to the UAS faculty who will be teaching the class. All of these classes, students earn high school credit and university credit.
Mm-hmm.
Can't beat the opportunity.
And the price is much less than it costs to take a course at UAS.
Right.
If you just walk in off the street.
That's right. The Exploring Careers in Education is actually being sponsored by some resources through the university and the Future Educators of Alaska. So it's a wonderful opportunity for students to check out another career that is in demand.
So, Karen, is organizing these kinds of classes, is that your job?
That is part of my job. I help facilitate the connections between our university and community partnerships and try to bring these resources and extensions of opportunities to our students.
You have quite an interesting and valuable role that you play.
It's a lot of fun. Uh-huh. It's a lot of fun. And I, what my goal is to make it accessible to kids and bridge career interests and information so that kids can see what the possibilities are and start earning at a great discounted rate credits.
You brought a handout here, and I'm noticing that some of these courses are like they go this fall, but then there's evidently a second part to the course in the spring.
Most
of
them are.
So the Principles of Engineering is a full year.
It's a full year.
Yeah.
The other courses that are on the list, and there are these flyers posted around the schools as well as in all the school bulletins from each school posting this information. And the school career centers have this information. So if you're uncertain how to go register for these classes, contact the career centers at each high school, and they can get your name and get it to the right person for the sign-up for the class.
The one I was noticing here is that you have the emergency trauma technician training course this fall, and then in the spring you have EMT training, complements that and is, again, another, well, that's a six-credit class.
It's a six-credit class, a lot more hours and intensity. And it requires an older student. You have to be, to be an EMT certified, you have to be turning 18 within a year of completing the class. So a 17-year-old could take it, but you need to be 18 within a year so that you can get your certification. Otherwise, you'd have to repeat the entire class over.
Mm-hmm. But there's ongoing demand for EMT.
Oh, my gosh, yes.
Yeah.
And the ETT class is open to 14 and 15-year-olds.
I see.
So you recertify every year by test, I believe. But beyond that, you don't have to repeat that class. Mm-hmm. So a younger student who's interested in getting the first start on this, it's a great base class.
Do students find out about these? You said they're up on bulletin boards and like that. Is there a more direct way that a student who's interested in these classes can contact someone that can kind of guide them into
these
programs?
We post it in the school bulletins. It's posted in the career centers, and try to get the information out to parent newsletters as well, and it's in school newsletters. Hopefully teachers read the bulletins to their staff, their classes every day in the morning, so students are aware of it. And school counselors all know about it, so as they're working with students on their scheduling and looking at their interests, they can say, have you thought about this class? So this is another opportunity for me to at least let the public know and parents know and remind them, particularly because basic instruction, ETT, and the Exploring Careers in Education classes are just starting up in the next week or so. And the other classes that start at 0 hour, it's still possible to get into them if you can make it work with your schedule.
So Principles of Engineering, Video Production, and CAD are the zero-hour classes, and then Basic Construction, ETT Training, and Exploring Careers in Education are the after-school classes.
Correct.
So a student who's interested in gaining both university credit and credit toward graduation from high school, plus a little very job-oriented, work-oriented course, this is the program
That's
for
right.
them.
That's right. These classes are great because they are profiling the high demand occupations and the opportunities that our own community, let alone our state, has in these areas. So it's a great start for kids to explore their careers and gain some college credits.
Karen, thank you so much, and thanks for your work in coordinating all of these programs.
Thank you.
An unforgettable evening of music, conversation, and much more. I'm Sewell Bailey, the Artistic Director of the Sitka Summer Music Festival, inviting you to join Juno Jazz and Classics as we take an incredible musical journey through all of Bach's six suites for unaccompanied cello. Saturday, September 8th at the Egan Library on the campus of the University of Alaska Southeast. For tickets, log on to jazzandclassics.org. I look forward to returning to Juno to share the wonders of Bach with you.
We'll find our way onto the program today with the music of Sewell Bailey. Andy Klein will be hosting the program tomorrow, and he'll be talking about the First Friday Art Sale at McFeeters Hall with guest Pam Finley. Joe Lyon will be here. He'll highlight the Early Learning Carnival, which is tomorrow. And the Alaska season at Alaska Boat and Kayak. Some folks will come in from that. And Cy Peck Jr. will be talking to Andy before he moves off to Maui. You're in tune with KTOO Juno. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juno and Douglas, and we also broadcast on translators throughout the area. In the Valley and Auk Bay, you can tune to K276 AF at 103.1. In Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, we're heard on K269 AO at 101.7. Gustavus hears us on K201 AM at 88.1. In Hoonah, you tuned to 91.9 listening to K220BT. Our signal is heard at 89.9 in Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait on K210 AS. In Juneau, you can also receive KTOO on GCI Cable Juneau. We're on digital channel 871. KRNN is on digital channel 872 and KXLL on 873. And we're also online with continuous streaming at www.ktoo.org.